Welcome to the Press One for Nick podcast. My name is Nick Blimsdahl. My guest this week is Chris Hood. He's a seasoned business strategist with 36 years of experience, who has propelled over 500 companies to a combined growth of $26 billion. Recognized as one of the top 30 customer experience gurus by Global Gurus in 2024. And his work with giants like Universal, Doritos, and Google has set new standards in customer experience and digital strategy. As the host of the Chris Hood Digital Show and the author of The Customer Transformation, he's dedicated to guiding businesses towards customer-centric success and has impacted over 4 million listeners worldwide with his insights on digital innovation and customer alignment. So we can keep talking about how awesome you are, but without further ado, welcome to the show, Chris.
Appreciate it so much.
So, you know, I think there's a lot of things that we can start off. We can start off with customer success or digital strategy or gaming, which I think we can always, which I want to dabble into a little bit of all of that. But you've been in Google before, Disney, Fox, Universal, kind of a lot of large organizations. What has been your favorite title to date and why? As a professional,
you know, I don't even really like titles. I think titles are inflated and stupid. You know, go make up a title. You know, you still have to go into work and do the job. You know, so I don't know. Titles are one of those interesting things that everybody tries to achieve and aspire for, but really, people are going to remember who you are and what you were successful at, what you did, what you accomplished. Like you just read through my bio. Not once did you actually say what my titles were. You said what I did, right? That's the mentality that I think people need to get into is go do something interesting. And what have you done in your career that you're most proud of? And those types of questions, I think, make a lot of sense. But look, everything from a C-level executive, like somebody might say, hey, you're a CEO. I would love to be a CEO. I would love to have that title. Then you also have all the responsibilities of the title, right? When I was at Google, I was head of digital business innovation strategy. You know, it's like, at what point in time doesn't even make sense anymore? So I think probably my favorite title of all time would be manager. Like, there you go. It's simple. People know what it is. You don't have to really go into and explain it. You know, when we were younger, that was really everything. It's like, oh, I just got promoted from sales rep to manager. I love it. But yeah.
It's so funny you said that. I worked at a nonprofit at one time, and it was a great nonprofit. We taught life skills to underprivileged youth. However, as a person right out of college, I was the national director of operations, and I was basically a minion, right? Like I had a big title because I had all the titles, because there was only like two or three employees, and but I knew that there was somebody who had a bigger title before I got in there. So I was like, this is so silly. Like, why don't I just say like account executive for this nonprofit?
So I mean, this stuff isn't new to anybody. Anybody who's been in business recognizes and understand this. Anytime you go to a website, all you want to do is like CEO, CMO, CTO, you know, director of national operations. Like, you put these things on your website for what we'll call credibility. No different than you say, we've got an office in New York and an office in London and an office in Spain. And, you know, we're global. Yeah, you have one employee in Spain who you've given a title of, you know, international success manager, whatever, and you're just doing it so that you can get, you know, maybe some additional credibility that, hey, we know what we're doing. It's all, unfortunately, it's all some level of manipulation, especially for smaller businesses, just to appear bigger than they might, you know, really be. But I think by now we kind of all recognize that.
Yeah. So let's start kind of at the highest level. You know, when it comes to customer success, how does Chris Hood define that?
Ooh, that is a good question, because I do think that a lot of people have different interpretations of what customer success is. or even what it means. And for me, customer success is not necessarily directly about ensuring that the customer is successful, whether that's onboarding into your platform, or whether that is that they have a long life, that they have continuous subscriptions, that the lifetime value is very good. Like, you know, I think customer success is a recognition that you are successfully delivering to customers, right? I'm going to take kind of a reverse perspective of that. Too often we are focused on maybe an individual customer, or even if we think about the customer personas at a large scale, we want to ensure that those customers are successful. I would much rather look at it as, is your business successful because you are focused on the customer, right? And the subtle shift in that kind of thinking helps organizations really become more focused on ensuring that the customer is being listened to, that feedback is in a continuous loop, that the experience for the consumer is positive, and that loyalty is being generated because you are, again, successfully able to deliver and meet the customer's demands. If you can think of it in that tone, then really what you're looking at is that customer success is an overarching way of managing customer experience, customer loyalty, customer satisfaction, customer support, customer service. Like, all of these things that we think about are a part of that success that you need to achieve.
Yeah. It's interesting because it's the mindset shift that needs to happen before action can occur. Because if you're saying you're focused on the customer experience, but all your metrics are not measured towards the customer experience, then effectively you're not going to lean in. The organization or the individual or the manager or supervisor are going to gamify the situation to align back to what their bonus is at the end of the year. And 8 times, 9 times out of 10, it's not going to actually be focused on what the customer needs are, or the, you know, more focused on the business outcome. So, you know, you kind of said there's these individual groups that ultimately focus on the customer success. One of those is that digital strategy. So, you know, from your perspective, how can those challenges be addressed to effectively improve that customer experience? And then how can organizations change that mindset moving forward to not just focus on profit, but actually focus on the experience itself?
Yeah, interesting enough, I just wrote a piece on LinkedIn 2 days ago about this topic. And I do believe that we are seeing a convergence starting to happen, or a recognition. It's part of that mindset shift that you're talking about. We're starting to see this convergence of customer success and digital strategy. Mm-hmm. Now, digital strategy is interesting because that's another area of a business that most people don't really understand, or they have a misinterpretation of what it is. Too often, 90% of the time, I would say, when I'm asked about digital strategy, it immediately is, well, that's marketing. Digital strategy is not marketing. It has nothing to do with marketing. There might be a digital strategy that is associated with marketing, but really it's about the recognition of what your entire organization is going to do around digital technologies, ultimately to meet the needs of your customers. That's digital strategy. So if we see that this is starting to converge, customer success and digital strategy coming together, I broke it down as simply as I could in this way. Customer success is about the who, and I need to pull this up because I literally just wrote it and I didn't memorize it, but I'm going to go grab it. Oh, of course I have to sign in and all this stuff. Never mind. Maybe it's on my phone. Man, this is real time, you know, podcasting faux pas for sure. Like, I should have all this stuff memorized and be on top of it.
No way.
But yeah, so I just wrote this, like I said, yesterday. And here it is. I've got it. So I broke it down that This is so embarrassing. It's not really, but it's funny. Oh, here we go. I found it. I really found it now. So I simplified it as customer success is the who, what, and why, and digital strategy is the where, when, and how. Now, I do think that is relevant because we often think that customer success, as we outlined previously, has to cover all of these areas. But digital strategy, because customers want to connect with you through digital platforms, and they want to engage with you, they want to write about you, all of their reviews about you are on, you know, social media, you know, all of these different types of platforms and channels that they use to engage with your company. That's that digital strategy piece, which is why it's so important that these start to come together. Because in order for your customer to be successful in their experience, you are going to have to provide to them very exceptional digital platforms to be able to accomplish that. And again, I think outlining it as success is really about the understanding of the who, what, and why, who the customer is, what they want, and why they are coming to you, and the digital strategy as being the where, when, and how, like, where are they going to engage with you? How are they going to accomplish that? And even when, you know, because we can automate a lot of stuff now, I think this is a good way for us to start to think about really how that digital strategy piece is going to directly impact customer success.
Yeah. What's your perspective and your insights when it comes to navigating AI to differentiate on the experience?
you won't like my opinion on this. Don't use
I think
it.
I think I will.
Don't use it. I swear, I cringe every time I see a post that says, leverage generative AI to improve your customer experience. Or somebody comes to me and says, we want to leverage AI for our customer experience. So you basically want to ignore customers completely. Got it. If that's what you want to do, go for it. Invest in AI. Here's a couple of things that you should consider. Number one, the biggest one, and I talk about this all the time, so I don't have to look it up. Number one is, have your customers specifically asked you for AI? If you're going through a traditional feedback loop and you're asking your customers what their needs and wants and desires are, and they have said, I need AI as part of my experience, then go do it because they've asked for it. If they're not saying they need it, which I beg any company to actually show me that they need it. If they're not saying they need it, then why are you doing it? So a broader way to look at this, and it goes back to what we were just talking about from the digital strategy and the customer success, is you have to come up with a customer value proposition for any digital activity you are going to do. Now, that's different because I think a lot of times people think, well, digital marketing, digital advertising, that's all digital. I have to invest in that to get to the consumer. Yeah, but there's still a value proposition then, right? Because you're reaching out to customers and they're coming in, they're making a sale. So you have to figure that out. And too often, I think businesses do the reverse. They say, hey, look, AI, let's invest in it and bring it in. And then figure out, well, now what are we going to do with it? What are we going to use it for? How are we going to help the customer with it? It should be, what is the value proposition for the customer going to be? What is the technology that we can get to achieve that? And then how are we going to use that and build it and implement it? That backwards mentality with starting with AI is just going to completely destroy your company. I'm sorry, but it is. And if you don't believe me right now, wait a couple more months while you're investing heavily in this and you realize we just wasted a bunch of money.
So I asked you the question because I had a feeling I knew the answer. And I asked it in a way where I was pretending that AI is the way forward, and I know it's not. I think AI could be used as a mode of self-service or check your balance or the update on your shipping info, or maybe it's on the agent itself, kind of on the back end for next best action if needed. But there's way too much emphasis on generative AI. If I go to any single conference in customer service or customer experience, one of the lead conversations are going to be around generative AI. And I'm saying, great, like let's look at the behind the curtain though on your actual foundation first, before you start talking about this whiz bang technology, the buzzword, and you're getting approval from leadership because it's the next best thing since sliced bread. When everything else is broken and your digital channels are siloed, and you don't have any reporting and you can't provide any insights. Yeah, but generative AI, you can only help the people who want helped. And when it comes to customer experience, ultimately, I just want my problem solved. And hopefully it is with a human, unless it is something very small or mundane. So I completely agree with you. So I did like your answer.
Well, so we are seeing this start to materialize. During the Super Bowl, Discover Card had an entire commercial on, you're speaking to a real person, not a robot, right? Their differentiation now is the fact that when you call in, you get to speak to a real person. They recognize that we as humans want to speak with other humans, and that we do not want to speak to a robot that has some sort of endless loop. And I do want to kind of justify and clarify my perspective here. First off, I created my first artificial intelligence program in 1999. So this is how long I've been involved with AI. I teach a course at Southern New Hampshire University on artificial intelligence. I am a strategic advisor for two AI-based companies. So it's not that I have no idea what generative AI is. Actually, I would say in most cases, those people who are coming to us with questions about generative AI and saying that it's solving everything, they don't know what AI is. They have this belief system in what it does. It's absolutely amazing when I think about generative AI from a customer experience, because honestly, that's like saying, hey, I want to put mustard on my peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Like, they don't go together. They're not meant to go together. Really, it would be as if you said, look, now chatbots aside, I have a whole thing on chatbots, but it would be like you have somebody who comes to your site and you want to create a story and you want to provide them some sort of choose your own adventure. So they come to your story and you're like, so you're walking through the store and you see something over to the left and something on the right. Which way do you want to go? To the right. Okay. Well, now on the right, we see this product A and product B. Which one are you? Like, if you wanted to have that kind of interactive experience as part of, you know, the journey, maybe you could use generative AI to do that. That's interesting. But experience is a human condition. Experience is about a relationship. You cannot build that or evolve that with generative AI. Generative AI is a search engine. We have it. It's Google. It's, you know, DuckDuckGo, go duck, you know, whatever. You know, I mean, we have search engines. So there's this real misunderstanding as to what generative AI really is. And I think people are trying to shove it in to say, look, we can help you solve your customer experience with generative AI. You can't, right? You can automate the experience. You can accelerate the experience. That will give you artificial numbers of improvement from your consumers because they get their answers faster. But long-term, that frustration will mount and you will begin to lose customers. I'm not saying it's the end all be all, but there is some balance that you have to consider. There is some level of automation versus human connection. And if you don't have that perfect balance, whatever that is for your organization, you will lose customers.
I'm so glad I poked the bear on that one. I got much enjoyment out of that. So thank you. I think in one of the articles as well, if it wasn't the one just a couple of days ago, it was one in here in the past, but you know, tell my listeners, for those who don't know, what the CVA metric is and then how that helps businesses measure customer success.
Yeah, the CVA metric, and look, there, I'll also clarify this, that there's a couple of different iterations of the CVA metric out there, but it stands for customer value alignment. There's another one out there called customer value analysis. The customer value analysis is really an understanding of trying to evaluate if the lifetime value of your customer is aligned with the goals strategically for the organization. Customer value alignment is the recognition that you have to be aligned with what your customers' values are or what is important and critical to your customers. And I will overly simplify this and just jump to the use case, which is if we look at Bud Light last year, Bud Light released a marketing campaign. Put the marketing campaign aside and just focus on the actions that Bud Light did. It was in direct competition or misalignment with what their consumers wanted. As a result, the consumers left, right? They boycotted and left. So this value alignment is to ensure that what you are doing across your organization matches with what your customers expect from you or have grown to expect from you. And it also recognizes that there is an alignment that needs to happen within the organization as well as outside of the organization. So the CVA works on a Goldilocks scale. So Goldilocks and the three bears, too much, too little, just right. And you ask a question, and the questions can be any number of different types of questions, but you ask a question and you survey your customers so that you get the benchmark of how they feel. Like for this particular area, they feel like it's too little, or maybe it's too much, or maybe it's just right. You want to be in, obviously, that's just right. Then you ask the same question to your C-level, to your VPs, to your directors, to your managers, to your employees, your partners, your stakeholders, your shareholders. Ask the question, get their response, and then you mark the same number. And as you start to look at this, what you'll see is where is the alignment and where is the misalignment. So if your customer comes back and they say, well, for this particular area, it's too little. And yet your CEO says too much and your employees say just right. Clearly, there is a misalignment across the entire organization that is not meeting the needs of your customers. So then you have to strategically try to figure out how to make that alignment work by getting the customers to where they want to be and then adjusting your employees and executives to that center point.
I like that metric because you're involving, it's a holistic metric. It's not just a metric of one thing and you're looking at it in a silo. You're able to see all of it and then analyze where the gaps are. Because then you can actually do something with it. Sometimes you have metrics and you say, 1 out of 10, how are we doing? Or would you refer us to a friend? And you don't ask the follow-up, the why, or what makes you give us an 8 or a 7 or a 4 or 2. Then you can actually, it's not an actionable, you're like, okay, well, where did we leak out? Where did the system break? And now what should we do about it? So I appreciate kind of that CVA metric. The one thing you touched on, you started first dabbling into AI and writing stuff back in 1999. I want to go back there for a minute because you touched on, you're now the CEO of Muddy Robot. Among other things. And that sounds like an awesome title of a company for one, but you know, back in 1999, you wrote the Gamers Manifesto. So how do you think the principles have held up since 1999? And are there any areas where the industry has maybe diverged from those ideals?
Yeah, so when we talk about the video game industry specifically, I think it's a great example of evolution of technology and consumer expectations demands. So if we think about even the early 80s, mid 80s, when we were introduced to, you know, games like Asteroids and Pac-Man, you know, later and, you know, Pong in the very early days, and And then we reached into, say, the late 80s, and we started to get into, the consoles and PC titles were evolving. And then we get into the 90s, and we started to get the introduction of online gaming. And then, obviously, the console wars happened, and online gaming exploded, and the amount of people who, started playing games increased. Then we got into mobile games, and that also started to increase. And all of this is directly related to technology and technology evolution. Obviously, devices got smaller. They were in the palm of our hands. They became more powerful. Online technologies got faster. The rate by which data could be transmitted increased. The amount of data that we could store increased, especially in smaller devices. So that evolution obviously also impacted people and playing games. If we look at the video game industry, and I think most people might not know this, and probably a lot of your listeners don't know this, the video game industry at whole is the number one form of entertainment. It has it is generating more revenues across all other forms. That includes movies, music, television, audiobooks, sports, podcasting, and in some cases, multiple of those combined. Video games passes all of those in terms of revenue and growth trajectory. Mobile games alone is projected to reach $775 billion in revenue by 2032. $775 billion. And that's just mobile. That's just that's not PC, that's not consoles, that's not your PlayStations, Xboxes, etc. That's an astronomical number to think about. And so when we look again back at 1999 and beyond, one of the biggest things happened, and there's a fabulous correlation here, is that because the technology evolved, how companies had to operate evolved. We would call that the early forms of digital transformation. But as that started to evolve, customer demands and expectations evolved. And again, those businesses had to figure out how to keep up with those changes. That has never changed, because I wrote a book, and I'm sure you'll ask me a question about it, but the book is called Customer Transformation. And the basic premise is that we as consumers are the ones transforming first. We and our expectations of how we want to engage with individuals, with other people, friends, recording podcasts, to playing games, to interacting with our business. Our demands are changing, and the companies have to then figure out how to transform to keep up with that change, all based on technology. And no difference across the gaming, because in 1999, we had no such thing as online gaming. It was new. And so it used to be people would go into a store, buy a CD, go home, put the CD into their computer. If it didn't work, they had no one else to turn to except go back to the store and return it. Well, now it's all online. Who do I call? I have to call somebody. I have to call into the support team. I have to sit there and deal with the endless loops and talk to another human being. And of course, at that time, we didn't have chatbots. And those companies weren't prepared for that. They weren't, because we were so used to, well, just go back to the store you bought the game from and get a new copy, right? Or return it if you're not happy. Now we had to have that direct business-to-consumer engagement to solve problems. And from there, the internet launched and everything else started to happen, which created a full cycle of businesses that had to actually directly communicate with their consumers to be supportive. And that's what we've seen across every industry, not just video games. And so I go back to, you've got to continuously have this focus on the customer and what their needs are and what their demands are, and listen to them and have the feedback and go through the process and not worry so much about that technology, because you've got to satisfy them first. And then along the way, figure out what you're going to do with the technology, no matter what the industry, doesn't matter.
Yeah. So you kind of touched on a little bit, but just a few minutes ago, you talked kind of about the ultimate feedback loop and the CVA specifically, but you know, is when it comes to gaming, you know, the coolest game that I ever had was Duck Hunt, of course. And I didn't return the game. I just put it underneath my shirt and start blowing on it, and it would work every time. So that was the trick to make it work. But you know, nobody, how often are they actually asking the consumers themselves what they would like to see here moving forward, and that next iterative change of that game? Or are they just excuse me, kind of hoping for that, hey, it seems like this is the next best thing, so let's move forward, kind of like AI?
Yeah. I think what's interesting about the gaming industry is they have one thing that a lot of other industries don't have. They have a very active community, right? There is a large community of people who play video games. And for any game that you play, there's sub-communities within those games where you can really keep a very good pulse on what the feedback is and understanding of, you know, when people are complaining, that those messages usually go to the top very quickly. A lot of other industries don't have that. You know, you're not going to see these very active communities in healthcare, for example. It's just not there.
Yeah, so, it would be very helpful if it was.
It would be. And again, in my book, I read a whole thing on building communities. So yeah, the communities is an important aspect. And I do feel that in most cases, game companies do listen to that community and they make adjustments. I think one of the things that we are seeing now, and we do see it again across a lot of industries, not just gaming, but definitely across a lot of industries, is this interpretation that I know what you want.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to build what I want, and then I'm going to force it upon you. And we definitely see that happening in gaming. A lot of times, hey, we've got an idea for a new character. We go and build a new character and we implement it, and then no one likes the new character. And that's usually because somebody just said, it's my idea, we're going to just do it. Too often, again, across other industries, I've got a great idea for a new product. I got a great idea for a new service, without that validation if consumers even want it. The same thing applies for the technology, for ideas, for services, for products. Like, start with a customer, figure out if they want it, and then go build it. Don't come up with your idea and leverage your bias to execute on it. And so, yeah, it's happening a lot, not just in gaming.
Yeah. The one thing you talked about also was the shift in the gaming industry towards from profitability over passion. And, you know, I'd love to get your thoughts on that and the similarities that you see even in customer service or customer experience.
Yeah, I think that's really the biggest challenge that we have here. You know, I just mentioned a moment ago that mobile gaming, $775 billion over the course of the next, you know, 8 years or so. Well, that's a lot of money, a lot of money. And what we are seeing is, because gaming technically is a business, it is an industry, it is making money, that the shift to let's just focus on what makes money has overtaken the focus on a passion for building games. In the early days, definitely, again, when you go back to, you know, Donkey Kong and Duck Hunt and, you know, some of the fun games, there is a genuine passion. Like, let's create something new. Let's create something that hasn't been done. Let's be innovative. I just have a story and I want to evolve that story. I want to make that story interactive. I want people to play my game. I want to build something that gives a different perspective and allow people to enjoy it. You know, if we think about, here's a great example. Walt Disney built Disneyland to have people come to the park to enjoy it. Disney Corporation today cares about profits. They don't care about the enjoyment factor that you are going to have during your stay at Disneyland. They really don't. Anybody from Disney listening, call me. They care about profits. Their profits have overtaken the genuine passion of just producing a product for entertainment. And you can see that in the decisions that are being made. Right. And so the gaming industry has gone through this. They are focused so heavily on the profits that they've lost sight of why the gaming industry has become what it is, because of that passion, because of that enjoyment, because of that entertainment, because of the stories, because of the engagement, the community. All of those things have been overtaken by profits. And we can see that transcend to other, you know, I talked about Disney, but we can see that in other areas too. Anytime an organization starts to focus more heavily on profits than consumer satisfaction, you lose those consumers. If you focus on consumer satisfaction, you become profitable. Like, it's always amazing to me how that gets turned around so easily in people's minds. And I've alluded it to oftentimes, it's greed, right? It just boils down to raw greed. We want more. Leadership wants more. Executives wants more. Shareholders want more. So, you know, layoffs are a direct correlation to greed. Google, as an example, you know, laid off, now to date, they've laid off 15,000 people. They also generated a quarterly earnings of $26 billion. So you're telling me they don't have the money? No, they just want more money. That's what it all boils down to. We go back to the gaming industry. Blizzard just got acquired by Microsoft. Microsoft, through Blizzard, laid off 1,900 employees in January. Why did they lay off 1,900 employees? It's not that Microsoft, and it's definitely not because Blizzard and Activision don't have the money. They are making gobs loads of money. Yeah. They're doing it because they want to readjust, restructure, go into something else. It's all business decisions. It's all driven by profits. It's all driven by ultimately greed. That passion that we have for just producing something that's going to entertain people has been lost. And my goal, if I can have one goal, would be to try to recapture that passion and reintroduce that opportunity for innovation into the space.
How would you go about that in the little bit of time that we have? Let's say you're talking to, you now have the eyes or the ears of the executive at Disney, whoever that might be, and who can actually do something about it. What would that message be to them?
Oh, man. I have thought about the Disney example. I've thought about for a long time because one, I actually love Disney. You know, I used to love Disney. Now they're kind of on my naughty list, but you know, I loved going to Disneyland. I grew up going to Disneyland and Disney World. I loved going to the park. I loved going for the experience, caramel apples. Like, you know, I loved all of it. There's so many things that they could do, right? They, everything from reducing the cost to get into the park, you know, figuring out how to adjust what they are focused on, right? Returning to the focus on entertainment and get out of the politics, which they're heavily in. Return to consumerism, return to pure entertainment. You know, I at one point in time actually created a list of, like, if I was CEO at Disney, here's the list of things that I would do. You know, I actually think they need to get out of the shareholder mentality. They have to get to a point where it's more or less employee and fan-based owned, like have customers own the company, because they think that would be so impactful to how the company could grow. You've got to return to your roots. They leverage all the time. Disney's vision was that Disneyland would never change. It would always continue to evolve. And I support that. But now you can see where the profitism is coming in, because every original ride is being updated or changed with, you know, some partnership or some theme overlay or something. All of that is based on, you know, profits. It's not based on innovation. It's not based on trying to come up with something unique or entertaining. So again, I think a lot of it is just shifting that focus back to what would the, you know, we could always say, what would Walt do? And I just don't think that Walt would be doing a lot of the things that they're doing.
WWWD is what, yeah. I hear.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's an interesting concept. I think it's, you know, ultimately there's a lot of organizations that need to get back to their roots to understand what the foundational values are, and then realign those with what the customer's expectations are, and meet somewhere in the middle, kind of going back to that CVA model.
Yeah. And real quickly, returning to your roots does not mean not evolving, right? There's a difference here. Too often we'll hear the comment, and you'll appreciate it, We've always done things this way. That's not what we're talking about. You can maintain your roots while still doing things differently. You've got to be very clear about what those roots are as a foundation and adhere to those while still innovating around them.
Yeah. So we don't have a whole lot of time to talk about the book. And I think we could have just spent a whole lot of time just on the book itself. But for those who have never read the book, don't know about the customer transformation, you know, what's the reason why my listeners should go to Amazon right after this, they listen to this podcast and say, yes, I got to have this book.
It's a bestseller. Yay. So I'm excited about that. The book is called Customer Transformation, a 7-stage strategy for customer alignment, which we talked about, and business value. It's the essential way to ensure that you are aligned with your customers and to grow value. Those 7 stages operate on what we call an outside-in perspective, and it helps you strategically understand each step of the process that you have to go to create a customer-centric culture within your organization that is going to thrive customer loyalty. And it's critical. It is mind-changing. It is definitely a different way to look at things. It's filled with tons of case studies and stories. And at the end of each section, I provide you with an actual action plan. So you can go through step-by-step what to do for that particular week, questions to ask, and different things that you have to do across different teams in order to implement that particular section. If you just go through the entire book step-by-step, you will have a customer-centric organization that, again, is just powering through and generating incredible value for your customers.
So you have to read the book and then you have to do something about it.
Well, yes. I mean, look, it's great if you're reading the book, but you know, the goal here is to improve your organization. And if you're not going to do anything, that's on you.
Exactly. So there is the pitch and I highly recommend it as well. So I'll put a link in the show notes and you know, I would recommend going and picking that up here right after this conversation. But Chris, it's always been a pleasure to connect with you. What's the best way for my guests to find you and connect with you?
Yeah, the best way is just hit me up on my website, chrishood.com, chrishood.com. And there you can find my book, links to my book. You can find my social media profiles, my blog, my podcast, videos, and more. So feel free, reach out there, chrishood.com.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Appreciate it.